I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time. Like tears in rain.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Pop Culture Ninja with Nathan and Nathan. Nathan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Missed the Jackie Chan intro a little bit.
Yep. Yep.
But what you just heard was a clip from Blade Runner, which isn't a movie we're going to necessarily be talking about today, but it's we're using it as the starter intro for a new series that we're going to start. We've now been podcasting for about a month, Nathan.
Yeah.
That's crazy to think. This will technically be our eighth episode.
Yep.
And we want to start a series where we can start looking at some things in depth. We're probably going to, over the course of the podcast, start a lot of different series. This is not going to be a thing where every single week we're going to talk about an element in the series, but rather start out, do one episode, then come back and do a later episode. And this episode is going to be the first of our Other Worlds series.
Mm-hmm.
We're really going to be talking about worlds that really fall within, I guess, science fiction and fantasy, worlds that are created in fiction that develop ideas and concepts through the world itself.
Mm.
And these worlds, they vary in terms of what they explore, what they're about, and even what genre they really fall into. But a lot of what's popular today was based off of concepts and ideas that were started in fiction a long time ago.
Yeah.
So we're planning to do a series that's going to look at dystopias.
Yep.
Everyone's favorite.
That's right.
These days, dystopias. You can't get away from the Maze Runners, the Hunger Games, or the
yep.
Divergence out there. And we hope to continue that series. We're going to do a series a little bit later in the summer about apocalyptic fiction.
Yep.
And then one about post-apocalyptic fiction. And then also kind of go back and look at the opposite of dystopia, utopia,
mm-hmm.
which is not really all that popular. That's when things are going well.
Right.
And
right.
mankind has a fresh, burgeoning future. So today we're going to be doing There Goes the Neighborhood, which is dystopia in fiction.
Yep. Yep. So, yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that you and I were kind of talking about is, as you mentioned, just how much dystopias have really blown up recently. And I think a lot of that can be attributed to the silver screen, even taking and adapting these pieces of literature that we see with the Hunger Games and the Maze Runner series, the Divergent series, and so many different things, and putting them on the silver screen and actually not doing a half bad job at portraying these things. It's really drawn in a crowd and drawn people to this type of fiction. So talk to us a little bit, Nathan. Tell us, why do you think that we're drawn to these dystopias? Why do you think it's something that we will go and pay to see, or we'll go and pay to read? What is it about them that captures us?
Well, I think we can also draw a little bit, if not a distinction, at least a differentiation between dystopian fiction as it originally began,
mm-hmm.
and then the dystopian fiction that we see right now that's really... we've probably seen an increase in popularity in the last 5-6 years.
Yeah.
You should probably look back, as you're talking about, over the past 15 years. The current trend, I think, is really most popular in the young adult vein of things.
Mm.
And if you go back to what dystopia means, you're really talking about the dictionary definition, saying a community or society that is undesirable or frightening, or even one that is oppressive and threatening.
Mm-hmm.
You can see how the idea of a society that pushes down on its followers and the people who belong in the society, how that would appeal to a young adult audience, to a young teenage kid who sees high school or school in general, or in parental oversight as something that is oppressive.
Yeah.
And the other element of a dystopia is, even though we talk about these dark worlds that are often inverted and oppressive and destructive, they are a backdrop in which characters inevitably rebel. And it's not just, I think, tapping into the sense of young people wanting to rebel or react or revolt from something, but in dystopias, when characters have to push up, and obviously in fiction, we always want to see strife, momentum, effort exerted because of what's pushing back on you. And so that's obviously one of the reasons I think dystopias are popular, because the young adult niche is looking at, when you're faced with the world and growing up, it's terrifying anyway. And to have characters who live in a world that's 10 times worse than the world you live in,
right?
I think that's a part of it. That's the appeal probably at the young adult level. I think the appeal on a larger level is that there's two things. There's cautionary dystopias, I think. Dystopias, worlds that are futuristic and have little elements here or there that have been tweaked that are plausible. And I think they relay our own anxieties about what we might face in the future or what our children might face in the future. I think that's probably what is most compelling now, where we live in a world where there's a lot of uncertainties. I mean, we need to really bone up on dystopias because, you know, in like 6 months, we could be living in one.
Right.
But you
with
know,
a wall.
Yeah, imagine a world where a wall encircles the United States. But we joke about that, but I think there's an element of that, that dystopias force us to not just confront the potential worst of ourselves, but also the potential best that can arise from facing darkness.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because in the definition of the dystopia, it seems that to a certain extent, it depends on, for the lack of better terminology, which side of the wall you're on. You look at the Hunger Games. I don't necessarily know that President Snow would have looked at the world as a dystopia. He may have been more inclined to think of it as a utopia, or if he had more of a realistic perception of it, the people who he may have had a realistic perception of it, but the people who are on the right side of the wall, the people in the capital city, are looking at it more as a utopia instead of a dystopia. And then you look at it from the viewpoint of Katniss and you see that dystopian aspect coming through. And I think those are things that are need to be considered when we look at dystopian literature or movies as well, is, you know, from what perspective are these things coming from? I mean, in some ways, Star Wars can be viewed as a dystopia. A future, well, technically George Lucas a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. But, you know, you get the sense that it's not always a certain term. It's more fluid through the eye, or it's more certain through the eyes of the person who is the protagonist, not necessarily the other characters.
Well, that's an interesting point, Nathan. I think that one of the probably a defining element of dystopia is actually that at some level it does look appealing on paper, because what we have, the difference between a dystopia and a apocalypse or an apocalyptic setting, is that really that's where the world is sort of crushed and broken down, and you're dealing with things like anarchy and chaos and a world that has maybe established some kind of order, but not a solidified order. A right. dystopia is a society, so it does mean at some level, somewhere, someone thinks or thought it was a good idea. And you're right, there's always an element to where some ruling class appreciates the dystopia for what it is, wants it to remain what it is, and that's why there usually ends up being a revolt. So I think probably an element that always has to be in dystopia is the idea that it is good for somebody.
Yeah.
And which is probably what makes it so compelling. And actually, when you look at the term, even before we had dystopia, the term was like kakatopia from the Greek, and it was actually used directly opposite of utopia, to say an anti-utopia, a utopia being a good place. Utopia was coined by Thomas More, who wrote a book called Utopia, and in that world he presented this great society, But in that society, there were elements, you know, they still had slaves. Mm-hmm. Travel was monitored. There was a weird bit where men and women had to see each other naked before marriage just to make sure they knew what they were getting. You know, a lot of weird ideas. But even in the book Utopia, which I don't think was intended to be seen as this undesirous place, there was always from someone's perspective that this was not a perfect world. Right. The obvious point of a dystopia, I think, and what something we can kind of take away as we look into them, is that there is no such thing as a perfect world. That's the thing that a dystopia underlines.
Right, right. Well, and, you know, we talked about the idea of what it's become, the dystopian literature has become in the last 15 years. But, you know, you think back to H.G. Wells, The Time Machine, and, you know, seeing a dystopian future that that has been traveled to in that book. And actually, I don't know if you saw the movie with Guy Pearce that came out. What was it, 2002.
I remember Jeremy Irons in a fright wig.
Yes, yes.
And I remember a lot of special effects.
Yeah.
Did you know that that movie was directed by, like, the great-great-grandson of H.G. Wells?
Really? Simon, I did Wells. Not.
He must have had something out for H.G.
I know. But you see that sense of, you know, it on the surface, it appears to be this calm, peaceful, utopian society. And what's interesting is many times in a dystopia, you are getting rid of technology. Have you noticed that? Technology has usually been abandoned or abolished or destroyed.
Or we've been swallowed by it.
Yeah.
Which I think is maybe we played the clip from Blade Runner.
Yes.
Blade Runner is a world that is a perfect example of what you said. It doesn't necessarily look like a dystopia to everybody, but it's very rainy. Earth is cluttered and choked. Supposedly, all the people living on the off-world colonies are living in some kind of grand luxury. We really don't know,
right,
because we never see it. But the oppressed class, these androids that have been built and have dates where they're going to die and they're used as slaves, from their perspective, the technology is destructive.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, I mean, there's so many different facets, and you talked about that idea of, you know, appealing to, you know, the young adult readers, but I think there's something that even appeals to adults in that, and, you know, just wanted to get your thoughts and perspective on the things that would appeal to the adults, to the older people.
So if you go back, and of course, we talk about, like, the classic. There are some classic, you know, I guess what we would like to call the foundations of dystopian fiction.
Yeah.
They would be stories like George Orwell's 1984, mm-hmm. Aldous Huxley's A Brave New World, Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. Yeah. All of those stories involve a very oppressive government. However, what you do have in all of those stories are adults who are pressing against constraints, against conformity, sometimes against what would be the ruling wisdom of the day. And that is something I think is, as we are no longer children, you know, as we are young adults, we have that striving against the supposed confines of the world. But as we get older, we do recognize that what we are sometimes straining against is our own limitations as people, and we are fighting against our weaknesses, our deficiencies. And then in addition, we are also straining against the greater world order, if you will, whatever social constraints that we live in and are against. And whether that is some element of going to your job every day, or that is an element of striving against social standards as you raise your kids, as you try to live your life, as you pursue your dreams and find that they are flummoxed, not necessarily because of any doing of your own, but because of limitations. And we have seen in our society, in our real world society, elements of people being oppressed, being held back. This isn't dystopia. We don't enjoy dystopias because we live in a perfect world and we can't get misery any other way.
Right.
But I think that what is compelling about them is they do, and the really good, turn a mirror back on our world. Mm-hmm. And I think that may be the difference I'm seeing where the kind of work that Anthony Burgess did in A Clockwork Orange, the work that is done in books that, you know, the books that we mentioned, some of the older books, and movies like Terry Gilliam's Brazil, where you kind of take what Orwell started and mix it with Monty Python and get a world cluttered with bureaucracy. And you will look at that movie and scoff at it until you spend 6 hours at the DMV one day.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that it is modern day frustrations that are writ large that allow us to have almost a catharsis with it.
Yeah. And, you know, those are so good. Excellent thoughts on that. We have essentially three dystopias that we're going to talk about. Again, we, you know, you go into adolescent fiction and, you know, we could just spend hours and hours. And as Nathan said at the beginning of the podcast, we want to establish a series in this and come back and talk about worlds. And we may even revisit dystopia at some
point
because
plenty of material,
so much out there. But we want to talk about three movies specifically. I'm not going to tell you what they are right now. We'll bring them up as we go along, just in case time forbids something. But the first one we're going to talk about is Equilibrium. I don't know how many of our listeners out there saw this movie. I remember seeing it when it came out in 2002, and I was blown away by it. Because this was around the same time that we saw the second Matrix movie coming out.
And it was a few months before.
It was, and I remember being extremely disappointed with that one. The first Matrix, I saw it. I was kind of floored by it, really enjoyed it. I remember in high school, my friends were going to see it. My older brother and I went to go see it together, loved it. And was excited for the second Matrix and was sorely disappointed with it. And then I saw this movie, Equilibrium. Wasn't too sure what it was, but so I went up, looked up a trailer of it, and went to Walmart and bought the movie. Actually, just went right out and bought it because it did not stay in theaters that long. So it was still within the 2002 year that it came out on DVD. Picked it up and, you know, thankfully the trailers were right. It was a fantastic movie set in a world where emotions, where feelings are controlled by drugs. And stars Christian Bale. Ty Diggs is in it as well. And you get some minor characters. Sean Bean, this was his phase. Well, I don't know if Sean Bean's ever career ever consisted of him not being killed in a movie. but this is, you know, another movie where Sean Bean meets his untimely demise, which actually is the catalyst for the events that occur in the movie. And one of the things that impressed me about it, other than I thought it was a decent story. I mean, I think the story's been done before, and there wasn't anything necessarily new or original. What really impressed me was, as a martial artist, this thing in the movie called the Gun Kata, where through science, through the study of movements in a gunfight, these masters have been able to predict the movement, not dodging bullets. It appears that they're dodging bullets, but they just know where someone is going to fire and when they're going to fire. And so they're able to not be in that spot. And as a martial artist, I'm looking at that and in my head going, okay, I know that's not possible, but in my heart, I'm going, I really want that to be possible. That's cool. And that's, you know, to me, that's one of the things that kind of really impressed me about this. And it, for the movie, it was interesting because it's an hour and 47 minutes. So by today's standards, it's almost a short movie.
That's like 10 minutes longer than some of our podcasts.
I know, right? and it really does, in my opinion, a good job of having a beginning, having a middle, and having an end. At least an end that's satisfactory for what they're trying to accomplish in the movie. Nathan, your thoughts?
I liked it too. I saw it the weekend. So it came out like December 6th of 2012. And so you probably saw it in 2013, which is when The Matrix Reloaded came out. It was released in the theaters with no fanfare at all. I saw it. I was in college at the time, and we actually had like a snow day. And a friend of mine, it was like the weekend right before Two Towers came out, so everything was backed off in terms of the movies coming out. So we were just looking for something to see. We saw this. We did essentially what you did. I don't know if we even watched the trailer. I think I saw read Roger Ebert's review, which was positive, and said, you know, let's just go do it. It's only, you know, $4 or $5 at a matinee.
Yeah.
And did really enjoy it. I will say, going in, it is a very silly movie. I think it's fair to say that it's silly. It takes itself very seriously, but I think even in its taking itself seriously, it understands that it is essentially a collage of classic dystopic beats.
Yeah.
There are a lot of references here. In fact, the entire world that is controlled by drugs comes from 1984, but from Brave New World, where the Soma drug is controlling. And in fact, you could write, we should do an article for Pop Culture Ninja about the various dystopic drugs and science fiction, drugs and science fiction. We could do Dune, we could do Limitless and other things like that. The Librium is the drug in Equilibrium, which keeps your emotions at a balance. The idea being that if your emotions are completely balanced and you are emotionless in a sense, that you won't commit crime.
Yes.
And of course, crime is being committed every day in this society by the Grammaton clerics, which are similar to the firemen of Fahrenheit 451 who go around. And in fact, there is a scene where Bale's character, who is a Grammaton cleric, actually oversees the burning of the Mona Lisa. Mm-hmm. It's discovered in a vault. Art, books, anything that make you think and feel are destroyed. And it is primarily an action movie. It does pull a lot of beats from The Matrix. The gun kata that you mentioned does add a little bit of spice and make it a little bit more interesting. Bale was doing a lot of silly science fiction movies around this time. He also did Reign of Fire. That was an apocalyptic movie full of dragons. And I think Equilibrium is a better movie than that. I never quite bought Taye Diggs in this movie because Taye Diggs is such an expressive and charismatic screen presence that you always saw him emoting. And so it seems strange that when everyone else, when Bale has to continue to act to be stoic. There's a really funny scene where he has to pretend to be stoic while a little puppy is licking his face. That Diggs always seems very expressive and cheerful. And it just, I always wondered about that casting. But I do enjoy the movie. I think that it is a movie that's a very good kind of jumping in point. I don't want to use my term from last week, but I will. Training wheels. It's a good point that if you have teenagers who are interested in science fiction, who know The Matrix and things like that, who maybe don't yet have gone back and experienced things like Fahrenheit 451 or Brave New World, Equilibrium's a nice entry point. I don't know how much new and original it had to say, but it was refurbishing some of these classic conversations that dystopias bring up.
Yeah, and the great thing about this is, you know, for those who have you know, teenagers, even younger who are getting into it, there's nothing that I would consider, you know, offensive in that regard, you know.
It's R-rated primarily for violence.
For violence, right. Yeah, there's, you know, there's not a whole lot of language going on, except, in fact, the language that's used is almost comical because they start saying something and something interrupts them and stops them from actually saying the full word. So it's almost comical in that regard. And, you know, there's no nudity or sexuality going on in it. And so it really is just to me, it reminds me of one of those classic action 80s movies that we hadn't seen in a long time without, you know, the nudity and the swearing. So I think, you know, for if you are looking at something, even, you know, if you have a, you know, 13, 14 year old who is more mature and, you know, doesn't mind violent movies, you don't mind them watching more violent movies, you know, I think even that young, it could be a good one that you could show them without having to worry about.
It's available on Netflix, I believe.
I think you're right. Yep. So, the next one we're going to talk about, and actually, I tried to watch this one, Nathan, but, you know, timing and couldn't really get a hold of it. So I'm going to let you go ahead and take it away and talk about this one.
Okay, next movie is The Lobster, and it's actually playing in theaters now. You're probably going to find it at your local art house theater. You may find it playing in one of the back theaters that is not showing Civil War or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles right now. The Lobster is a movie directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, and it is a... It's not a foreign language film, even though it's directed by a foreign director. It stars Colin Farrell. It has Rachel Weisz in the cast. There are several other actors that you'll recognize as you go along. John C. Reilly is there. And this movie is a dystopia, but it is another example of a dystopia that's a little bit different than the ones we've talked about. Mm-hmm. We just discussed Equilibrium, which is both allegorical and futuristic. It is expected that it takes place in the world that you and I know down the line.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it is allegorical in the sense that there are a lot of symbolic things that stand for other things. The Lobster is a different sort of dystopia in that it is not exactly cautionary because it doesn't seem to take place in the world that we live in. It is rather meant to be a critical, I think, almost satirical.
Yes.
But it isn't... I wouldn't call it allegorical. I'll tell you the plot. So it is in a world that seems very much like ours in the terms of the buildings aren't extravagant or different. There is no great production design in terms of this looks like a world that we don't know. The cars and everything are what we would expect to find in our world. The clothing, no melding of time periods or anything like that. All of that is normal. But it takes place in a place called the city. That's all that we are referred to. Doesn't tell us where exactly. This world is a world where basically single people are more or less outlawed. You can't, if you are single at some point, whether this means that you are single because you could never find a mate, if your mate died, if for some reason you were separated and went your separate ways, then you are round up at some point, collected by the authorities, and taken to a place called the hotel. In the hotel, you now basically participate in what's almost like a reality television show without the cameras. You have 45 days to find a romantic partner, someone that will now make you a couple. And if you don't do that, at the end of the 45 days, they will take you aside and you will get to choose what animal they turn you into, at which point they release you into the wild. And you go about your life as an animal because you were not a successful human because you failed to couple. So that's the basic gist. When Colin Farrell ends up at this hotel, he was previously married, he's not now. There's not a lot of details as to what exactly happened. It seems that his wife left. We're never really sure if she left or if she died, but he's at the hotel now, and he is going through the process of trying to find a mate. And everything is done very clinical and strange, and they put them through a lot of very weird routines. In the very beginning, they have their one leg tied behind their back and one arm tied behind their back to teach them that you need two things at all times. So it reinforces this idea. At one point, they're doing marksmanship, and the guy says, it's no surprise that the targets are single people or shaped like single people. And as you go through this world, Farrell spends some time in the hotel trying to find a mate in various ways. And what is interesting is there's also this sort of idea or undercurrent running through the hotel and all of the society that your mate will be someone that complements you in all the same traits that you have. So you, if you have nosebleeds, that makes you more likely to be with the person who also has nosebleeds. There's a scene of one character smashing his head into an end table so he can have a nosebleed, so he can find something in common with the nosebleed girl, and he'll have a successful hookup. Now, of course, what it leads to is lots of people pretending to be things that they are not, sometimes to extremely dark and disastrous results that really are viewed through a very darkly comic lens. This movie is very sardonic. It stands away from everything and observes it in a very blackly comic way. Things that are not really funny, but you find yourself almost ready to chuckle. There are scenes of Colin Farrell kicking like an 8-year-old girl in the shin with his foot. And see, I chuckled when I said it. And there are other things like that. But what there's a very dark current that starts to develop in this movie. At some point, he gets away from the hotel and joins the Free People in the Woods, who are basically that rebellious group that we talk about that is made up of people who want to be single. But of course, the single people have their own laws, no coupling, so they all stand and dance slowly by themselves pretending that they're dancing with someone else over in the woods that they wish they were dancing with. But if they do, there are punishments and consequences for that.
So they become Baptists is what you're telling
me. Yeah, yeah, kind of. And right, and then they just have giant potlucks in the middle of the forest. It's a very dark movie. It is an R-rated film, and a lot of the elements are very subversive. You watch this, and while you're watching it, you always have to kind of keep in mind that this is meant to be a reflection of our society and pointing out elements that not just about society, but I think the thing about the lobster is it really wants us to examine our own human nature. Mm-hmm. And one thing that you can kind of expect from most dystopias, they will highlight what, you know, from a spiritual or Christian perspective, you might call the depravity of man or the degenerate nature of mankind, and that is really the fallen nature of man. And that does come to light in The Lobster. Here's something that anyone who goes out and check this movie out, and you'll know if it's in your wheelhouse. If you like darker, stranger movies,
right,
you think you can deal with it, I would recommend it. It's a very fascinating movie. It's almost just a little too cold for me. I was never able to latch on to the characters, but what was going on in the movie carried me through. This is a world, I think, when you talk about a dystopia, one of the things to look for is what really makes it different from our world? What's the broken part? Mm. Equilibrium, of course, the broken part is that everybody has emotions and they can't suppress them.
Right.
And so here's a society that's pretending to be this thing. In The Lobster, what you start to realize is that nobody in this universe is capable of a sacrificial act. And that has led to this idea that everyone needs to be together, that you can't have people separate. And all through the movie, each decision that people make because of this standard is that they always make decisions that are in their own best self-interest. They will lie to their partner because it benefits them. They will lie to society because it's the only way they can keep going. The people who live in the forest will come out, kidnap members of the people who are coupled together and hold them at gunpoint in what looks to be, you know, like a scene from like Clockwork Orange, where you're afraid they're going to horribly murder these people. And they really just set it up so that they can force these people who are coupled to realize that they don't care about each other because no one is willing. Mm. And this movie goes all the way to the end. And I won't talk about like the ending, but even the whole movie, you're waiting for the sacrificial act, for what the thing that's going to redeem somebody or something in this movie. And it's probably not a spoiler to say you're still waiting. You're literally left waiting when this movie completes. So something to think about. And I think a really cool dystopia in the sense that it starts to make you think about your own actions and relationships and how selfish they are, or how you can be less selfish.
Very interesting. So check out The Lobster in theaters now. The last movie we're going to talk about, and we're actually going to spend the majority of our time talking about this one. It's an older one, bordering on classic. One more year and it'll be 20 years old, man.
That makes me sad because I was sitting there thinking, oh, pick a more recent dystopia. Yeah. And, you know, we picked this and you're right. It's 20 years, huh? Yeah. Close to 20.
Yeah. And we're talking about the movie Gattaca. I don't know how you can talk about dystopias and not talk about this movie. I remember I told Nathan, he was asking if I had seen it because we were going to talk about it. And I was like, yeah, I think I saw it when it came on to HBO back in like 1998. You know, that was the time where we had HBO and we were taping like every movie that came on. So I think at one point we had recorded it off HBO and could rewatch it. And so, you know, I wanted to go back and watch it and refresh myself on what was going on. And you know, I'm amazed it's still held up. It's still a good movie to go back and watch even almost 20 years later. And I think part of the reason is because these are things that we are still facing and struggling with today in society. If anything, you know, it's interesting because we look at this and we're like, oh yeah, this is dystopia, but you're reading some of these things that are going on in the movie in the news about people being able to pick and choose certain features and characteristics that are going on in their child because of where we've come in genetics. And so I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Nathan to give us our description, and we'll go ahead and start talking about it.
Yeah, Gattaca, I think, is cool as a dystopia because it's not what we would expect in terms of being this super, at least from the outset, from the exterior, this super oppressive world or a world that looks very different from ours. There's no one easy element that says this is broken beyond repair or it's absurdist in some way. Mm-hmm. Gattaca falls within that cautionary science fiction that we talked about where it's taking things that are happening in our world and positing what it would be like if these things came to fruition. Not yeah. an absolute, but a likely potential for what human nature mixed with technological invention or ingenuity would result in. And I think that's what makes the movie interesting. So it came out in 1997, mm-hmm. like you said, I think October of 97. It's one of many movies. There were a lot of really great movies that came out in around that time, 97, 98, and 99, mm-hmm. particularly in the science fiction genre. I think this is when you got some of the most recent movies that we can go back and say are science fiction classics. Some of the last real science fiction classics, I think, to come out were around that time frame. Mm-hmm. In like 97, 98, 99 is when you had The Matrix. 98, mm-hmm. Andrew Niccol, who directed this movie, also wrote The Truman Show, which was later yes. that year in the 98 in the summer. And I think that's a great movie too. And from a perspective, you could argue a kind of dystopia maybe. Yeah. But Gattaca starred Ethan Hawke and Jude Law. They were the two primary stars. Hawke already had kind of a name. I think Jude Law was close to being an unknown at the time. Gattaca was the first movie I remember seeing him in. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was his first movie, but it was the first movie where it turned me on to him in terms of like, hey, I don't remember seeing this guy before. He's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Uma Thurman was in it. There was a lot of great supporting cast and Alan Arkin. Yeah. Gore Vidal, the author, plays the head of the Space Academy, Gattaca. Which is where the title comes from. And Nathan, I'll let you talk about in a minute what Gattaca yeah. really represents. But the movie does take place in a world that is hearkening back a little bit to some of what Aldous Huxley was suggesting and Ray Bradbury were suggesting. But it's a little bit more subtle, I think, in what it does. It has some very beautiful production design, and it creates a world that looks like ours, but seems to mesh a lot of time periods together a little bit. What's interesting about this movie is it has some technology that is very modern. Some of the design in the space stations are very modern. They're getting ready in the context of Gattaca to actually go to places like Titan. So their space programs have taken off, while at the same time, some of their other technology and then some of their other inventions seem to be a bit dated. They all wear fedoras. They all kind yeah. of wear slouch coats and stuff. And it doesn't seem to be just a stylistic choice. There's also, they're driving cars. He talks about that he was conceived in the back of like a Ford Riviera or right. something like that. He talks about the Buick LeSabre at one point saying there's a car accident. Somebody pointed out once that, you know, the Buick LeSabre stopped being made in 1993. And so they're faulting the movie with, okay, you didn't know that the car wasn't it was no longer in production. But I think what is being suggested in this world, the underlying element of this world, is now genetic modification has gotten to such a point, genetic selection, if you will, that you can choose what genes your child will have
yeah.
when they're born. And what this really means is kind of this eugenics come to life. They can yeah. actually go through and take away things like myopia. They can stymie the genes that would cause you to have any number of illnesses or potential weaknesses. When they draw the blood, it shows them information that allows them, in whatever way, to postulate when you might die. And so this does split society between what we would call faith births and people who are created in the system. The parents go in, they sit down in front of a monitor with a doctor, and he chooses which traits. You can choose a boy, a girl. Mm-hmm. You can choose, you can even start to, for an apparently in a deleted scene we saw, for an underhanded fee, you can even choose to have them so they are more inclined towards being a pianist or a Olympic champion or something like that. That's the world is set up in, and they break down invalids and invalids.
Yes.
And the... In the context of the movie, Ethan Hawke's character is Vincent, I believe.
Yes.
And he is born, he was a faith birth. His parents conceived him naturally, or what would be considered in the world of Gattaca, right. the unnatural way.
The unnatural way, yes.
And then he's given this sort of...
Profile.
Yeah, a profile, profile with a ticking clock that kind of suggests that he's going to be weaker. He isn't going to live that long. I think they estimate he's going to live about until he's 30, and then that's going to be it for him. And they, the, his parents choose to have another brother, who's Anton, short for Anthony. And he, and Anthony is the chosen one, if you will,
because
he's literally the chosen one in the sense that they sit down and they pick out all of his traits. And so he's constantly in the shadow of his brother. He watches the rockets take off from the Gattaca Space Center, and he's dreaming of what it would be like to go to space because his opportunities on this world seem to already be scuttled before he's even started.
Yes. Yeah, you know, and what's fantastic about this movie is the amount of detail that is placed on making sure everything is just so. And what I mean by that, actually, interestingly enough, I remember going to a science a symposium, for lack of a better word, when I was in high school shortly after this movie came out. And the person who was there talking to us referenced Gattaca so many times because of how accurate and how detailed the movie was in terms of what could be done and what couldn't be done. And at that point, they were still mapping through the human genome. And so, you know, going to Gattaca, even the title, this is the DNA sequence. The DNA sequence consists of four nitrogen-based I think it's nucleotides, adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine. So in Gattaca, you have guanine, adenine, thymine twice, adenine again, cyanine, and then adenine again. And then, you know, a lot of people have looked at it, and, well, they weren't that attentive to detail because, you know, Gattaca is just something they made up. It goes to the repeat sequence of the genome. So when you're going through these DNA sequences, that's actually how it is. Gattaca. So it would be G-A-T-A, and then C-A would be the repeater. So C then to A. So, you know, these guys did a great job at looking at detail. There's a scene in the movie where Jude Law's character asked to be called by his middle name, Eugene. Well, Eugene is the Greek word for, it actually means well-born, and it's the term we get for eugenics. You know, so there's so much going on in this movie that as you do a cursory watch through, you're looking for these different, you're looking at all these things that are coming in, and then it really takes more going back and looking through it to find the details that went into making this a movie that 20 years later is something that is amazing to watch.
Yeah, that's a great point, Nathan. I think that's one of the things that we're talking purely from a movie perspective makes any kind of movie where you're talking about creating another world interesting.
Yeah.
The movies we've mentioned do that. Little details are what really are the spice of these sorts of things. Gattaca is an insanely detailed movie. I remember the first time I saw it and enjoying it, but not quite delving in or engaging with the story at that point, which brought me back for a second viewing and then a third and a fourth and realized that there is quite a bit of depth to it. But that first viewing, just thinking alone that, wow, not even just the world and the underlying details that you mentioned.
Yeah.
We'll talk a little bit more in a minute about the names and stuff. But even the level of fastidiousness to what happens. So if we talk about basically what happens is that obviously Vincent wants to become part of the space program. He can't because he's an invalid. And so the best he can hope for is to join the crew that washes the windows and cleans the floors, the janitor crew, who's run by a guy named Caesar, who is played by Ernest Borgnine.
Yes.
And in one of his classic little crusty performances, he doesn't have a lot of lines, but he's a great sort of presence, and he's the head of the group. You know, he comes up and smacks him on the head and says, "Why are you dreaming of the stars? You want space? You can clean this space right here.
That's right.
This space over here." And what Vincent has to do is actually, in this world, in order to get ahead, he actually is going to have to not be himself, to be dishonest, because the world doesn't give him essentially any other choice. So he makes this decision to participate in a ruse, the kind of thing that happens sort of the underground that nobody really pays attention to, which is that invalids have the opportunity to take what is called a borrowed ladder or a Jacob's ladder, which is, I think, a term maybe from the script that didn't end up in, I can't remember if it ended up in the film or not, but I know in Nicole's original script, they called it a Jacob's ladder, which is obviously a biblical allusion.
Right.
And actually the story of Jacob and Isaac has a lot of parallels to what happens with Vincent and Anton in the film. But the borrowed ladder is a valid who, for whatever reason, has maybe fallen on hard times, has not met the potential that they could have had. And it is in their best interest to sell out their name to an invalid, their identity, if you will. And there's a go-between. In this movie, go-between is played by Tony Shalhoub, pre-Monk. And he comes in, and what happens is Vincent will take on Jerome. And you talked about how Eugene means well-born. Jerome actually means sacred name. Yeah. So even to that degree, where Jerome is going to be the sacred name, the cover, if you will, that Vincent is going to put on. And when he does this, it's not just his name and his credentials. He has to, this society is so concerned about, even though it's supposed to be discrimination, they still are constantly surveying to make sure that invalids are not among the valids.
Yes.
So they're constantly scouring to find hairs, skin follicles.
Yep.
So Vincent has to regularly go through this process of scrubbing himself down. The amount of detail that goes into the script to make sure that the film is true to this concept of having these sterile locations, people constantly combing for hairs, constantly looking for skin follicles, having Vincent keep cleansing himself the way he does. It's just an enormous amount of detail. And that detail is appreciated because I think it builds a real, believable world, and it opens the door for the movie to swing the other way and be allegorical at the same time and have a little bit of depth to it.
Yeah. Well, when we keep talking about these invalids, you know, and you even think about the play on word with invalid, and that's essentially what they're talking about in this society. There are these genetically modified people who are, you know, the valid people, the perfect people, but then there's the invalids or the invalids, the ones who have imperfections, the ones who don't have what you're looking for. And it's interesting because at the beginning of the movie, you know, they talk about, oh, you know, we're not supposed to be discriminated against, but yet you build a world where it's very easy to discriminate. You know, he talks about, if you just go in and shake the person's hand.
A regular drug test will give you the same information that you need.
Yep.
And we talk about the names. It's interesting to note, too, if we kind of go back to the Vincent, Anton, Jerome, and then later we meet Uma Thurman's character and her name. Remember who?
Yeah, she's she's the
Irene.
Love interest, Irene, yep.
And Irene, they kind of form this group that represent the different ideas that I think Nicole, as a filmmaker, is trying to say this represents what this society, and a society like ours that pursues perfection beyond what we've been provided, when we pursue this perfect ideal that is beyond human potential, or we want to achieve greatness in and of our own strength, our own ability, our own will. And at some level, all these characters are involved in that sort of a race, and it's showing, I think, these are the sorts of traits that this society could potentially produce. There are positive traits. There are positive elements to Vincent's character. There are also negative elements. I mean, he is in a society where essentially he has to lie and be deceitful in order to get ahead. But if you look at Vincent and Anton, who we see them as young kids, and Anton kind of lords over his brother, the fact that he is the genetically perfect child, even though he's not genetically perfect. The funny part is Anton has been one of the designer babies, if you will. But even when we see him later, and I mean, this is an old movie, so spoilers, you know,
abound.
Right, will abound. When we see him later, he's part of law enforcement. And there's kind of jokes made through the movie by the characters. They're not jokes to us, but, you know, that, oh, well, maybe he can be in law enforcement. He can't go all the way to the top. Even within the span of the Gattaca elite, Anton hasn't really met his potential.
Right.
The funny thing is, all of the elite that we meet are all stymied in some way. None of them have met their full potential. Jerome has suffered. We believe it to be an accident, but it turns out that he really stepped in front of a car.
Yes.
So it's interesting because he's now an actual invalid. He's in a wheelchair, and he did it himself of his own mindset because he also realized that he was kind of always second. He was supposed to be this Olympic champion, and he's always got the silver medal. He never has the gold, which comes back in at the very end. But he's stymied. And what's interesting is the so-called free people, the people that seemingly have all the options, are really the ones that are enslaved here, in a sense. They are the ones that are limited by this idea of perfection, this idea that we have to achieve this, and it's like a sentence around their head. You are this good, and this is what you will be.
Yes.
And you must be and achieve this. And it's interesting because I feel like one of the things that I've heard, particularly when you get into Christian critics or philosophers talking about this movie, they always kind of come at it from the angle of Gattaca being a story that ultimately relates back to like an anti-abortion or a pro-life story or something that speaks against meddling with nature and with God, and which I think is definitely an aspect of the story. But I think there are other ways. Gattaca is such a versatile story. It can be read in a lot of ways. Certainly, it does open up with that Ecclesiastes verse about, you know, what God has made crooked, will you straighten it?
Right.
And which is interesting, too, when you look at the invalids, and the valids have individual signals in signs.
Yes.
And it's a cross for the invalids, and then it's actually like an eight. Yep. Sort of for the valets, which is actually interesting because it's the valets who have the curved, crooked sign. And in Gattaca, though, one of the storylines that I feel is very poignant to me and is probably something that I think a person can experience whether they are in any kind of social group or any society or even within a religion, when you start to weed out grace and compassion and those elements and only focus upon achievement, it's when you really create a prison for people. And I think that if you look at the perspective of Gattaca, there's a lot of things that happen in Gattaca. Vincent comes up against his brother in the beginning, and they have a race in the water. Water is a constant theme in this movie.
Yeah.
And they swim out, and Vincent makes it out, even though Anton feels he should be the one. He has the ability. Anton starts to sink and drown.
Yeah.
And Vincent comes back and gets him. This is replayed again at the end of the movie when Anton wants to have another race because he does not understand how his brother can do this. And as Vincent leaves him in behind again and comes back and gets him and brings him back to the shore, he says, how have you done this? He says, well, I never left anything for the journey back. And so there is another element where Vincent is constantly looking to the heavens, in a sense, to the sky.
Right.
He wants to go into space. He wants to explore because Earth doesn't seem to hold anything for him anymore. And I think that what we see is Vincent goes all the way as far as he can, even with Jerome's borrowed name. But towards the end of the film, he still... There's a whole kind of subplot murder mystery. I don't think that stuff works as well, but involves the director sort of. The director ends up murdering someone so that the
program
can continue and the space mission will go on. And by the time he's arrested, it won't matter because the spaceship will have launched. It was a director that didn't want it to go through. So that storyline is on the side. What it allows, though, is for a lot of interplay between the detectives and the other characters. And in that, you have Vincent coming up at the very end. He's almost got through everything. The suspense of will they catch him before he goes into space. And he comes up against one last guy, played by Xander Berkeley, who he's interacted with several times. It's the DNA guy who runs the scans, and you got to do one last pee test before you head up into space. And he knows that he's done. He got all this far. No one would have ever been the wiser once he's up in space, and this guy gets him. And at this moment, this is one of the There's several, but this is one of the few moments of grace in the movie where the guy knowingly, you know, already has known for a very long time who he is, has known his identity, explains to him that I have a son. He's not he's not what they would have hoped. He's a faith child, which is what they called him in the film, just like Vincent. And so this act of grace allows him to go into space and complete his mission, whereas Jerome, on the other hand, has, you know, his life has been kind of scuttled. He's just collapsed under the weight of this. And some people read his final suicide as a sacrificial act that sort of redeems him in that he is disposing of the last piece of evidence that keeps, that is tied to Vincent on Earth, which is Jerome. And so he climbs into the incinerator. It's a very kind of, for me at the time, it was a kind of a heartbreaking scene because he's, while we see him ascend, we see Vincent ascend to the stars, and head towards the heavens, we see Jerome incinerated in flames and in, you know, in fire. And there's a couple things. One, you see his silver metal turns to gold as it burns in the flames. Visually, you see that. So there is an element of redemption, potentially. Maybe there's one reading. I think there's another reading, though, that Jerome is that for Jerome in a world like this that is that provides no grace, who it's solely upon Jerome's works. Jerome has just done the best thing he can do by helping this other guy, and there's nothing left for him. He has no other hope beyond that.
Yeah. Yeah. So many good points, and there's so many things that you could pull out and read. And the great thing about this movie is that the director of the movie, the writer of the movie, clearly intended for this to happen with this movie. It's clear that there is intent for discussion and for reflection and to really ponder where are we going with where are we going in society? You know, there's always the thought that, well, as a scientist, I'm just responsible to make the discoveries. I'm not responsible to ask the questions of the who, the why, the what, the where, all that. And I'm just supposed to make the discoveries and report my findings. And this movie delves, I think, a little deeper into that, commenting that, well, no, there's a responsibility to, you know, ask those questions and discover, you know, what does it mean to make these discoveries? What would we give up if we allowed these things to fully come out and fully come to life and fully just be in our society and run our society like this? And I think what we're finding is, interestingly enough, again, you read in the papers, we're not too terribly far away from this type of a society becoming a reality.
And, you know, something I think is worth mentioning about Gattaca, Gattaca is not a Luddite film, if you will. It's not a movie that's actually down on science at all.
No.
In fact, in the world of Gattaca, space travel is good.
Yeah.
It's seen as a positive thing, which is interesting because essentially exploring the creation is great.
Right.
Trying to, it's not even recreate the creation, but to manipulate and adjust the creation to what you want it to be.
Yes.
It's sort of where they get into the dangerous territory. And the movie, again, is really good, I think, about not being this anti-technology movie, but really being a story about what potentially can our technology do to our humanity.
Well, and I think, too, it shows that no matter what technology will do and no matter what we do to technology and how we use technology, the human spirit is what's going to persevere above all that. It doesn't matter who you genetically modify to do what, you know, at the end, you know, that quote that you said when they're racing, you know, and the idea is who can go the furthest and then turn around and go back. You know, how is it you've been doing this? I didn't save anything for the return. You know, everything Vincent did, he's pouring out into his goal to go to space. And so there's nothing that is going to stop him. It doesn't matter if he's got heart disease. It doesn't matter if he has asthma. It doesn't matter what he has. Nothing is going to stop him from achieving that goal.
There's a couple interesting scenes I think are worth mentioning if we have the time in the deleted scenes for the movie. One of them involves Caesar, the character we mentioned played by Ernest Borgnine, where Vincent, when he's leaving, gives him his old telescope.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really kind of cool, showing he's pointing out, he's giving him the next tool that he could potentially use to move himself away from, not necessarily that insinuating he should go join the space program,
right,
this telescope that he can go and look at the stars and understand that he's unfettered, he's not held down by this society.
Yeah. No, great discussion, Nathan. And we're going to go ahead and we're going to end it there. If you haven't seen Gattaca, go ahead and check it out. It is definitely worth your time. You can find it on Amazon Prime. Was it on Hulu as well?
I don't know if it was on Hulu or not. It'd be good to check. I also want to say, starting this weekend, I'm going to get on the Goodreads, put up a list of dystopia fiction, do the same on Letterboxd. But what I want to do, maybe starting this weekend, Nathan, I think it's time we kind of start our first poll.
Yes.
We'll do a poll and get people to write in. And just let us know what your favorite dystopia is, whether it's in movies or books or even video games. I'd love to hear about it. We'll compile a list and we'll put them on the Facebook. If we have the website up and running, we'll get something like that started. I'll put more details up, but it's something I'd like to do. And stay tuned. We probably will revisit dystopias at some point. There's so much to talk about, and we will do more episodes of this Other World series. Thanks a lot for listening.
All right. Thanks, guys. See you later.
Really shook the pillars of heaven, didn't we, Wang?